In cybersecurity, speed isn't just an advantage, it's survival. SOC Radar is your early warning system against hackers. SOC Radar continuously monitors the external threat landscape, so cyber threats hit your radar before they hit your business. But it doesn't stop there. SOC Radar empowers your company with proactive exposure management, actionable insights that help you stay ahead of cyber criminals and minimize business impact. And with SOC Radar's holistic exposure management, you get complete visibility, attack surface monitoring, dark web monitoring, threat intelligence, and brand protection are all unified in one powerful platform. SOC Radar isn't just another tool. It's your frontline defense in a world where threats never sleep. Start your free trial at socradar.io/podcast. That's socradar.io/podcast. Don't wait.
Can we talk something else? Can we talk about something else?
Hello. Out there. I live in one of those small, dusty places where the occasional passenger train slowly rolls through and the people on board likely think to themselves, who the hell would want to live here? In fact, they're probably looking directly at my house when they're thinking it. And that's fine with me. Growing up, I rode the train a lot to visit my dad in the city. It always fascinated me to see the little boys and girls waving from their junky backyards along the way, along the tracks. To them, I was just a shadowy head, a shadowy hand, waving back. I wondered what their lives were like. I imagined, probably poor. Now, those are my kids, and their friends, waving from the top of a snow-covered gravel mound in the winter, posted up on their bikes, filthy little fists yanking at the sky come summer, willing that lumbering, diesel-belching steel dragon to let out a roar, just for them. And despite the way things may seem to those catching a glimpse of the little lives and little places as they pass through, everything is just fine here. Though some of those shadowy heads aboard, undoubtedly, doubt that. Some, like today's subject, maybe find themselves thinking, boy, those kids sure would be easy to steal. Especially the snot-nosed boys. Who would miss them? Well, I, for one. Welcome to Dark Topic, I'm your host, Jack Luna. This is a true crime happening. Nebraska Boy Snatcher. I want to talk about the last one first and the first one last. That's a quote from the so-called Nebraska Boy Snatcher, John Jubert. He said this in an interrogation room at the Bellevue, Nebraska police station on January the 11th of 1994, after having eaten a Big Mac with fries and a Coke, after the Eagle Scouts' other request to be visited by a young troop member whom he'd become quite close with had been satisfied. John Jubert had wanted to assure this unsuspecting Boy Scout who matched his victim's profiles that he'd never been in danger, that their friendship had been real. Jubert, 20 years old at the time of his arrest, could have been mistaken for a Boy Scout himself. In reality, he was a maintenance mechanic and radar tech training at the local Offutt Air Force Base, who volunteered his services to the scouts in his spare time as an Eagle Scout. And the reason he could have been mistaken for a Boy Scout was that Jubert was short for a grown American white male at 5'5", though he was powerful, but not obviously well-built. With his large, unsettling, sick puppy dog eyes and clean shave, Jubert could have fooled anyone into believing him to be a teenager. And he had. Most notably the 11, 12, and 13-year-old boys who lay dead in his wake. We won't count them down, like Jubert wanted. The little prick was accustomed to getting his way by the end, was addicted to it. So I'm not going to give in. Even though there's train track to follow, a scene of blood-splattered snow that matches the tone of my intro so well, I planned on talking about the last one first. You see, until I heard him say that. Let's instead start from the beginning. Back the train up to where this bite-sized killer had yet to cut his teeth, let alone chew, into a child with them. John Joseph Joubert IV was born July 2, 1963, in Lawrence, Massachusetts. His parents didn't get along. His mother Beverly dominated the house. His father Jack was a disappointment to her. He hadn't evolved into a breadwinner, though he did serve bread as a waiter. Jack Joubert was supposed to have inherited his parents' restaurant, Joubert's Diner, but it had been closed rather than handed on. This made for a miserable mood most nights in our subject's, John Joubert's, childhood home. Mom worked long hours as a bookkeeper, and Dad was gone nearly every night bussing tables, serving, cooking, doing everything he could to make up for what he'd lost. Young John Joubert spent a lot of time with his baby sister being babysat. He hated this. Hated his sister and his sitter. Joubert's earliest homicidal fantasies would start here. As a child, he remembered wanting to kill the babysitter and then eat her. He was consumed by these thoughts, as was his sitter. Joubert would later claim that having witnessed late-night drunken fights between his parents had been what truly screwed him up. And forgive me, but I have to say that if witnessing domestic violence as a child turns you into a Nebraska boy snatcher, then you better hope that I don't ever visit Nebraska. In 1971, at the age of 8, John and his little sister were unceremoniously uprooted from their childhood home by their mother and transplanted to a cramped apartment across town. Their father, Jack, had run out of time. He kept the house, as it wasn't his, rather his parents'. Beverly couldn't do it any longer. They were living like a couple of kids who were too useless to make it on their own. Jack couldn't do anything right. He was supposed to be running a restaurant with his name on it. Instead, he had a name tag on a dirty Denny's dish pig shirt, and the only thing he ran was Beverly's head into the walls when she gave him a hard time about it. Beverly had chosen a dud for a husband who was becoming an abusive drunk, and she wanted nothing to do with him any longer. Too much time had been wasted. Even though her kids still had a good relationship with their father and wanted to be with him, they were forbidden by their mother to even talk to him. John Joubert would later point to his mother's domineering and unreasonable nature throughout his formative years as being part of the reason why he ended up so screwed up. He and his sister were still being babysat directly across the street from their former home when his mother left him. Young John Joubert would try to run over and speak to his dad if he saw him out there, say, shoveling snow or taking out the trash. A little late, Jack. But the babysitter would near strangle John to keep him back. His mother had given the sitter strict orders, no contact with that sack of shit across the street. It was hard. Life was miserable under mother's rule. John Joubert grew to hate her. His dad proved to be a bona fide letdown as he didn't bother fighting for his kids or to help their situation much. Joubert's small stature came into play as he hit puberty. Not only had he been dealt a shitty hand, but shitty feet and shitty legs, shitty everything. It seemed he was simply stunted, coming up short in just about every facet of life, like his father. John Joubert was picked on all through school. He was said to have an impressive intellect, but couldn't crack the code on being likable. He sulked a lot, bitched and moaned. Kids who begin turning out like how Joubert is here are almost impossible to warm up to, especially for other kids. Why would they bother? I don't care how tough things are, you gotta be open to the possibility of them improving. If not, well, I guess life really does suck then. On his early report cards, it was repeatedly noted that Joubert did not play well with others. There was something wrong with him. These issues in his formative years, according to Joubert, are supposed to give us some answers. But all I have are questions. Questions like, how does any of that justify becoming, by the age of 20, a serial killer known as the Nebraska Boy Snatcher? It was 1974 when 12-year-old John Joubert was dealt the worst blow to his developing self-image, leaving it crooked for the remainder of his life outside of a prison. His mother uprooted he and his sister once again, this time leaving the state and moving 100 miles north to Portland, Maine. John protested, saying he'd rather stay in Lawrence with his father, who had now remarried, Mom smacked him upside the head and threw the little squirt in with the luggage. The fact that Jack, the father, had managed to move on without the mother, Beverly, and the kids is what likely spurred this abrupt upheaval. John Jubert, small and strange, wasn't exactly built to be the new kid in town. He had trouble fitting in and making friends. By grade 6, everyone has pretty much established themselves in the elementary school hierarchy. Jubert entered the classroom not as a fresh face, but rather as fresh meat. To say he got off to a rough start would be an understatement. Jubert was asked immediately by some of the boys if he was gay. Back in the mid-70s, and for a small-town kid like John Jubert, gay still meant happy. Though it was a little bit of an old-fashioned term, even by that point. Jubert, confused by the question but eager to socialize, answered the boys with a, "Yeah, I'm gay. Why do you ask, fellas?" And that was that. The new kid was gay. Jubert stayed that way all through middle school, then through high school. He never stood a chance, never had a girlfriend, and never developed any real friendships. Jubert was just angry and embarrassed and scared. He never recovered. Being gay, and if I wasn't clear there, he thought that they meant happy. Being gay in the 70s wasn't easy, especially when you weren't even gay. Or at least, he didn't think he was. Jubert lacked any ability to roll with the punches. Everything stuck and festered until he grew old enough, strong enough, crazy enough to do something about it. He tried to find peace through the Boy Scouts, where he ascended to the highest rank of Eagle Scout, but alas, he still wasn't cool to the boys or attractive to the girls, though he now knew how to take charge, tie knots, and use a pocket knife, which came in handy when, by the age of 16, he decided to start randomly attacking kids for kicks. October 1979, Jubert is volunteering at the public library. Volunteering is what good people do, so sometimes bad people use the practice as cover. The cold autumn afternoon sidewalk outside of the library would be marked by Jubert's first frozen footsteps towards hell. He followed an 8-year-old boy who caught his attention. Jubert never got over the bullying of his youth. Any kid could get it going forward, boy or girl. He'd find, like on this day, that boys were more accessible, easier to catch alone, quicker to gain the trust of. "Hey!" Jubert shouted this one word once he'd tracked the boy from his bus stop outside the library to an alley beside a nearby bank. The little boy stopped and waited. He was almost home. The shortcut took him off the main road where his mother would rather he'd stick. The boy hadn't seen the sense in that until the next moment when the older boy approached and grabbed him by the throat, pinning him to the brick wall of the bank, making him pay for a debt he wasn't responsible for. Most of Jubert's face was covered by a scarf, but his eyes blazed as the boy squirmed beneath his awesome strength by comparison. His size was deceptive. No child would immediately be intimidated by Jubert. And those eyes, now brutal and bulging, were, up until the point of attack, simply big. Beautiful, even. At least that's what his prison girlfriend from Ireland with the little boys of her own would later say. Yeah, that's right, he gets a girlfriend later. Now who's gay? Well, not that it really matters, but I think Jubert deep down was not happy, but homosexual. That's what pissed him off so much about being accused of it early on. You can have a dipshit prison girlfriend and be gay at the same time. It's really easy. A lot of guys in prison do it. Anyways, Jubert strangles the kid until he senses someone coming and lets him go. The boy runs home and tells his mom what had happened when she sees the marks on his throat. But his description of Jubert isn't much to go on. A short, deceptively strong teenager with big eyes. Police are called by the mother, and then they're on the lookout, but it's not enough to stop what has been started. Tuesday, December 11th, 1979, just after 4 p.m., John Jubert is riding his green 10-speed bike around town looking for trouble. He has a few hobbies, scouts, volunteering at the library, and his paper route. This ride has taken him away from any of the familiar locations where he does that type of activity. He knows what he's doing, is a very sophisticated sexual sadist and sociopath for 16. Yes, he is sexual. None of his crimes will suggest this, but later Jubert will admit to having a photographic memory of his crimes and to having relived them frequently while masturbating. It helped that he could draw. Some of the sketches later released to the media were dead ringers of his crime scenes. But we're not there yet. Jubert is still warming up, which is made easier in December. on a 10 speed. Jubert has a pencil in his hand. He's looking for a place to put it, and finally finds it when a 9-year-old girl appears at the edge of a yard up ahead. She is bending over to pick up a ball. Jubert speeds up and reaches the girl just as she's standing. He plunges the pencil into her back. It snaps off in her flesh, and he drops it. Jubert speeds away, and the girl goes running for help. When her parents find the broken pencil a quarter inch into their daughter's back, they call the police. A short boy with big eyes on a bike. Interesting. Investigators are concerned enough that they have the pencil pieces left behind at the scene analyzed for fingerprints. But no luck. Jubert had been wearing gloves, and even if the prints had been left, he did not have a criminal history. But he now had the attention of Portland PD, and he knew it. Jubert had a decision to make: cut it out or get serious and cut deeper. January 24th, 1980, sundown. 27-year-old university student and future teacher, Vicky Goff, is walking to her evening courses when a short, stout young man in a tan coat with a light-colored winter hat pulled low over his eyes approaches her from behind. It's dark, so there are no witnesses but her to what happens next. Vicky's face is grabbed by a gloved hand, and her stomach is stabbed into with a knife. The attacker rushes away as soon as he's dealt the blow, and his victim is left gasping on the snowy, street lamp-lit sidewalk. She can't breathe. Vicky's right lung has been punctured, and she can't catch her breath. It's like trying to fill a torn balloon. The injured woman stumbles to the first house she sees. An old man comes to the door, but will not open it. Vicky is whispering, "Help!" She must seem like a crazy person, someone scary. Whispering help, over and over, to a frightened old man in the dark, through his door. Finally, she gives up and moves back to the sidewalk, lurching like a villain in her long coat and looking like one with her scarfed face. She understands how she looks, how she sounds. And I gotta say right now, I understand how I sound. I've been very sick. Forgive my fucking voice. She wonders if whatever the young man had done to her has already done her in. Mrs. Goff makes her way to the university and finally finds help. She doesn't blame the old man. It was a young one who'd done this. His vague description is broadcast on the Portland radio that night. John Jubert is listening. They don't have much, but he knows it's time to get a darker jacket. Better for hiding the blood. Anyways. March 24th, 1980. Exactly 2 months later. Jubert is standing atop a snow-covered hill, impatient for a child to come sled it. It's broad daylight, but still, no women even. He'd settle for a broad at this point. The streets are deserted because of the snowy conditions and cold weather. The area is not yet terrified of the soon-to-be-dubbed Woodford Slasher. Finally, one brave boy comes along, bundled up tight like a package. 9-year-old Michael Whitham hears someone call out, "Hey!" and looks up to see Jubert, who from this distance appears to be a friendly little boy, waving to him. Michael, curious, begins the climb. When he reaches the top of the hill, he's met by a big-eyed boy who is actually a teenager. He wears a dark coat, pants, gloves, and hat that match his demeanor. Jubert asks the boy where he lives. When the 9-year-old turns to point out the direction, his throat is slashed by an X-Acto blade. The little boy turns to see what more will go wrong, but Jubert simply motions for him to run. The boy does, screaming for help down the hill, holding his throat that has a flap of flesh hanging from it, bleeding everywhere. Thankfully, the wound isn't fatal, though it takes 12 stitches to sew up. The cut, it's deep, as is the fear in the community following this attack. Jubert rides his bike 125 miles back to Maine to visit an uncle at this point. It takes him 7 hours to get there and 7 back. When he does that return trip days later, the heat hasn't died down. At his Boy Scout meeting, he hears of the dreaded slasher case. He and his fellow scouts are told to be on the lookout and to help protect their community. Jubert feels guilt, not for what he'd done or for what he still planned to do, but for causing the community he was sworn to honor as an Eagle Scout all of this concern. What a conundrum. Uncommon goods, everybody. The holidays are almost here, and if you still have names on your list, don't panic. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. You'll discover presents that feel meaningful and personal, never rushed or last minute. I got something here for the Secret Santa I have to attend. And some of those people there are drinkers, so I thought, hey, these Himalayan salt tequila glasses, a set of four, these are going to be a hit. They naturally salt the tequila or the mezcal for you. And they got a little tray for your limes and a board that it comes on. I'm going to get invited to every single Secret Santa available in coming years in my community. Uncommon Goods has something for everyone. From moms and dads to kids and teens, from book lovers and sports fans to foodies, mixologists, and gardeners, you'll find unforgettable gifts that are anything but ordinary. Support artists and small independent businesses. Every purchase at Uncommon Goods is a chance to choose something remarkable and feel good about where your money goes. With every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back a dollar to a nonprofit partner of your choice. So, don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/darktopic. That's uncommongoods.com/darktopic for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary.
In cybersecurity, speed isn't just an advantage. It's survival. SOC Radar is your early warning system against hackers. SOC Radar continuously monitors the external threat landscape, so cyber threats hit your radar before they hit your business. But it doesn't stop there. SOC Radar empowers your company with proactive exposure management, actionable insights that help you stay ahead of cyber criminals and minimize business impact. And with SOC Radar's holistic exposure management, you get complete visibility, attack surface monitoring, dark web monitoring, threat intelligence, and brand protection are all unified in one powerful platform. SOC Radar isn't just another tool. It's your frontline defense in a world where threats never sleep. Start your free trial at socradar.io/podcast. That's socradar.io/podcast. Don't wait.
August 22nd, 1982. Now 19-year-old John Jubert has managed to keep his nose clean and escape capture as the Woodford Slasher. But there's something about 11-year-old Ricky Stetson, a red-headed, freckle-faced little guy, that just makes him want to kill him. It's around 8 p.m. when Jubert spots Ricky running, jogging, on a countryside trail in a place just outside downtown Portland known as Back Cove. Ricky is wearing a gray jumpsuit with red, white, and blue accents. USA, stenciling, blazes across the chest. He is training for track and field, but could be, if he'd known the danger, be running for his life. The 11-year-old's father, mother, and older brother pull up alongside him as he jogs in their vehicle. They yell out and tease the boy. Ricky smiles and tells his family he'll race them. Dad gets serious and reminds his boy that there's about an hour of daylight left, then speeds away. Ricky doesn't even have that much time left. The sun is going down on more than just this late summer's evening. Jubert is riding his bike along the Back Cove trails, trying to clear his head of the dark thoughts, when he comes upon Ricky jogging ahead. It's assumed from this point that Jubert catches up to Ricky and begins a conversation. Whatever was said doesn't really matter. We know the conversation leads to beneath a pedestrian footbridge that crosses the I-295, where the body of 11-year-old Ricky Stetson is found at 7 a.m. the next morning by a passing motorist. In the grass, blood soaked through his jumpsuit, which was still on him, though had been manipulated at some point since Ricky had suffered a fatal stab wound to the chest that had not pierced through his sweater. He'd been mauled, molested, strangled with a ligature, stabbed. His pants had been attempted to be pulled off, but the drawstring proved too tight. The whole thing must have happened in a frenzy. Jubert went ballistic, then fled the scene, but not before leaving what would become his signature, a large bite mark on the boy's calf that had been sliced at afterwards with a knife. There was no obvious sexual assault, though the crime was relived by Jubert frequently while pleasuring himself later. He did this most often in the barracks of basic training out in Texas, then his quarters of the Air Force Base in Nebraska. Jubert joins the military immediately after committing this heinous crime. Another man, 24-year-old Joseph Anderson, was arrested for the murder of Ricky Stetson. Anderson had been a suspect in the recent murder of a 9-year-old girl, so he was an easy patsy until police could find the true killer. The problem with Anderson was that his teeth impressions didn't fit the bite mark left on the boy's calf. But the impression he made on the public upon being arrested was more important. Everyone was satisfied that the werewolf-looking loser could have done this, so it was enough for the time being. John Jubert got comfortable quick with his life at Nebraska's Offutt Air Force Base. He'd made a friend in basic training named Eric, and the two had decided to take the same path through their careers, which is kind of gay if you ask me, and the other guys at the base. Rumors spread that Jubert and Eric were lovers. This was just like school had been. As soon as he gets to the new place with the new people, new possibilities, boom. Everyone's calling him gay. And back in the early 80s in a place like Nebraska, that wasn't cool. Cornholing was a game, not a lifestyle. Speaking of games, by this time, Jubert had gotten pretty immersed in Dungeons & Dragons. He was a proud game master, liked the control and role-playing of the practice. Everybody thought this was pretty queer, too. And I know this language and tone of homophobia can be upsetting, so please just try to understand that I'm the GM of this podcast. I'm just trying to be authentic to the place, time, and circumstances. But I'll tell you that some of the most honest, loving, and funny, worthwhile to be around humans I've ever known are gay. And if I'm going to try to be authentic, then I must tell you that gay people in my life have done nothing but make me happy. And I know why. It's because they found a sense of freedom in their lives. And if that's a roll of the dice as the GM, and if it shakes out that that makes me kind of gay, then I guess I'm happy with that. So just wanted to get out of fucking trouble there. Eric decides he needs to be placed in a different room than Jubert. He stops talking to John as a result of all the teasing. This breaks Jubert's heart because he is gay and thought he was in a gay relationship, likely. Unhappy and angry, Jubert joins the scouts as an assistant scout leader. There he meets the teenage boy I mentioned in the beginning, and they strike up an unlikely friendship. Today it would be frowned upon if a 20-year-old Eagle Scout started hanging out with a 13-year-old Boy Scout after hours, but that's only because of all the sexual molestation claims and similar situations that have come up since 1982. It's tough to believe that John Jubert may have been seeking out real, meaningful relationships, and not angling to kill on a more intimate basis as he matured. We'll never know. Jubert burned too bright and was caught too quickly. And we may genuinely be able to thank the good Lord for that. Sunday, September 18th, 1983. 13-year-old Danny Joe Eberle is running so late for his paper route that he doesn't bother putting on socks or shoes. He's at the door of his Bellevue home on his bike, towing his empty red wagon about to be filled with neat stacks of the Omaha Herald by 6 a.m. It's an unseasonably warm day, thankfully. Danny Joe, a good-looking, corn-fed, dirty blonde-haired, crystal-blue-eyed, square-jawed, all-American paperboy, wears shorts and a t-shirt. He's a tough kid either way. Bellevue, Nebraska is a military town, most of its residents being employed by the local Offutt Air Force Base. Danny Joe's father would later lament that his son could have fought. He would kick himself for not drilling it into the strapping young man to use his strength if ever in a situation where it could be useful. Danny Joe had been spotted by John Jubert that morning, just before 6 a.m. Sunday was Jubert's day off, and he'd gotten up early after a sleepless night where he'd been bothered by an itch. Something deep and insatiable in his wretched soul that demanded he go out and find something special to kill. Jubert is drinking a Mountain Dew out front of a quick shop, observing a tanned, barefooted Danny Joe across the street in the Dairy Queen parking lot, retrieving a bundle of papers that had been left there for him this early morning. And for those who have never delivered papers, that's the way it worked. At least it was when I was a kid. The newspaper company hires a guy to go around to particular spots like a 7-Eleven or a Dairy Queen in this particular situation and drop the papers off for the local paper boys. They come by, they grab their big bag full of papers, and there's another bag with flyers, and then they sit there and insert the flyers and go on their way and, you know, deliver fucking newspapers. Danny Joe, he's inserting his flyers and stacking his 80 or so papers neatly in the wagon attached to his bike. And if this is starting to sound a little familiar, let me help. In Des Moines, Iowa, on September 5th, 1982, almost exactly a year previous, Johnny Gosch had been poached by a predator or predators in similar fashion. Perhaps Jubert had been inspired. In fact, for a spell following this particular crime about to unfold, Danny Joe Eberle was thought to have been a victim of the same perpetrators who had stolen Johnny Gosch off his own paper route. The difference is, Danny Joe Eberle's body was recovered, and his case has been solved. Jubert followed the paperboy out to the beginnings of his route. The streets were deserted this early Sunday morning. Joubert now had a vehicle, a tan-colored 78 AMC Concorde, and you couldn't cast a better vehicle for the kidnapping scene coming. A flat-hooded, boxy sedan, it rolled low to the ground as if stalking the boy on the bike. Joubert waited until the boy stopped at his first section of houses before parking the vehicle in an empty church lot. Having been a paperboy himself, he knew the routine. The boy would likely take care of a few houses at a time, parking his bike in the middle of a section, then run up to each door, rather than roll his bike and wagon to each walkway. This is exactly what Danny Joe Eberle had been doing when John Joubert approached. The bike and wagon were leaned up against a short brick wall in front of the town dentist's home, one of the more sprawling lots. When Danny Joe returned to his bike after having delivered his first three papers of the morning, John Joubert was waiting for him. "Hello," Danny Joe said. Joubert looked around. Nobody seemed to be watching, and they weren't, so he approached the boy, put a hand over his mouth, and quickly brought out a fillet knife from its sheath on his hip. He put it to the boy's neck. "Don't make any sounds." Danny Joe complied. He dropped the one remaining paper in his hand, then was pushed quickly across the street to the relatively private church parking lot. Joubert got the boy up behind the Concorde and popped the trunk. He forced Danny Joe to his stomach. The boy was in shock, speechless. Joubert quickly tied the hands behind the back, then the ankles. He rolled over Danny, who got a good look at him as the duct tape went over the mouth. Those blue eyes, filled moments ago with friendliness and innocence and life, now were pools of desperation, fear. Then, once Joubert tossed the bound boy into the trunk, deep despair. "Why didn't he fight?" Dad would later say. "Well, strapping or not, a 13-year-old boy is still a lot of little boy on the inside." Danny Joe Eberle's nearly naked bound body was found off a road by a nearby chemical plant. The chief of police found him. The scene is thought to have ruined the disposition of more than one attending official. Suicide in the ranks became too normal in the years to come. Sometimes you can't put your finger on just what's wrong with some people in some places. And sometimes you can't. Joubert later shared that Danny Joe had allowed him to untie his wrists and ankles so that he was left just in his underwear before retying him. The point? Joubert read True Detective magazines, and often the victims were left tied up in their underwear. Joubert also shared how he'd taken the tape off the boy's mouth to hear him beg before stabbing him to death while biting deep into the boy's flesh. The boy's father had to identify the body. His mother, later, would come across Danny Joe's younger brother, Steve, neatly folding clothes in the bedroom he'd shared with Danny. The clothes were Danny Joe's. When the tearful mother asked why her remaining boy was doing this, he looked up and she could see that he was silently sobbing. Quote, "I want to show Danny that I'm grown up now." Less than 3 months later, the early morning of Friday, December 2nd, 1983, 12-year-old Christopher Walden, a fresh-faced kid who could have been in a movie playing the part of a good-looking all-American boy, steps out of his Papillon, Nebraska home at around 8 a.m., calls out goodbye to his mother, then starts walking to his elementary school. Christopher is bundled up for the weather, thanks to Mom, who made sure of it as he tried to escape the house while still looking cool. As he begins the 20-minute walk to school, he becomes happy for the mitts, hat, and scarf. It's snowing and blowing. Visibility is low, yet John Joubert spots the boy just fine. He's perfect. Even beneath the layers, Joubert can see that the boy's well-built. When he parks up ahead, then walks up to accost Christopher with his knife, Joubert is pleased to see how handsome the child is. A woman will witness this abduction. She watches as Joubert approaches the smaller boy through the snow, has a quick interaction, then puts his arm forcefully around Christopher's shoulder and leads him to a tan sedan. Later, under hypnosis, this woman will vaguely be able to describe the vehicle and provide the first letter of the license plate. For now, this does nothing to help the boy who's blubbering on the floor of Joubert's Concorde as it takes off into traffic. Joubert will later claim to have had thoughts of just dropping him off at school. He felt sorry for him. But then he passed the school and kept driving until he got down a dirt road in a rural area where he demanded Christopher get out of the car, walk through the snow beside a railway track for a while, and then strip instead. Christopher Walden, 12 years old, still holding his school books, puts them neatly down in the snow, then gets down to his underwear. "Now lay on your stomach." This is when something new happened. Christopher Walden, who does remind me of Winnie the Pooh's Christopher Robin, stood up for himself. No. John Jubert doesn't know what to do. He never heard that word from a victim before. He'd heard please and stop and don't, but no, wasn't really something he'd even fantasized about before. Though, after this, he would. Jubert knocks the boy to the cold, snowy ground and starts strangling him. Christopher manages to break free, but is then stabbed in the back multiple times before his throat is slit, and he lays face down, motionless, bleeding out. Jubert bites, then carves a design into the dead boy's chest. A badge, maybe, for his bravery. Rabbit hunters will find the 12-year-old 3 days later, splayed out beside his books with his name, Christopher, written on them. The boy is naked save the underwear and a coat of snow. Barbara Weaver, a devoutly religious wife and mother of two, couldn't stop thinking about those poor boys and their families. By now, there was a wanted poster circulating of who was becoming known as the Nebraska Boy Snatcher, a little guy with big eyes, wearing a winter hat. Dear Lord, please put this man in my path. An unusual prayer, don't you think? Crazy even. Maybe crazy enough to work. They say the Lord works in mysterious ways. Maybe you just need to say the right thing at the right time. Like a child shouting to a wrestler making his way to the ring. Once in a while, a high five is thrown. Sheriff Pat Thomas holds a news conference on December 6, 1983, a day after 12-year-old Christopher Walden's body is found. His intent is to piss the killer off. He wants the Nebraska boy snatcher to make a mistake. It's a risky play, but what have they got to lose? Besides more boys.
Sheriff Thomas issued a challenge.
And I think that the individual who's responsible for these acts is very sick, spineless, a coward. And I would urge him to call a minister or a priest or me.
Christmas, then New Year's pass without incident. Jubert masturbates to the memory of his victim's final moments. Despite that cop kind of pissing him off, he's pretty sure he can keep it together as long as he remembers killing those three boys and can jerk off to it all the time. He thinks that he can hold off until he can't. Jubert can't get over being called spineless. He has the idea of visiting a church and minister in mind, as was the suggestion of the smug sheriff. Jubert has a confession to make. Killing is fun, and he can't stop doing it. Also, it doesn't have to be little boys. Anyone can get it. The morning of January 11th, 1984, Barbara Weaver is preparing to teach preschool classes at Aldersgate Methodist Church when she spots a Chevy Citation circling the neighborhood. Although the vehicle doesn't match the tan color residents have been asked to be on the lookout for, Barbara knows her prayers have been answered. The man driving the darker vehicle wears a winter hat. His eyes, glaring at her standing at the church doors, are huge. When the car pulls in and parks before her, Beverly begins memorizing the license plate. To this day, she could tell you the number, 59L5154. This number will later lead investigators to a repair shop. Jubert is driving a loaner as his tan sedan is in for repairs. Maybe a new paint job, too. Speaking of paint, time to paint this church's insides. Or something. Jubert acknowledges that the whole scene is weird. It's as if this lady at the door has been waiting for him. He's in tears when he gets face to face with her, through the glass. Barbara bravely opens the church door. Jubert can't look at her. He instead whispers, "Can you tell me how to get to 48th Street? Barbara tells him how, noting everything about the little man. "May I use the phone?" Barbara tells Jubert that the church doesn't have a phone. And this obvious lie breaks the barrier. It was almost as if Jubert couldn't cross the line until the lie. He pushes through the resistance of Barbara leaned on the door. When she realizes she won't be able to hold him off, she reefs the door open, and the killer goes stumbling into the church. Barbara runs. She slips on a patch of ice in the empty parking lot, save Jubert's vehicle, and falls to all fours. Then she hears the car start up behind her. "He's gonna run me over." Barbara, living up to her last name, weaves and gets to the adjacent property. She then sprints to the neighbor's home and comes bursting through the door. The resident there, a woman, knows Barbara. "Barbara Weaver, What in the name of 59L5154? 59L5154. 59L5154. And so, that's how John Jubert ended up eating a Big Mac at Nebraska's Bellevue Police Department, confessing to the whole mess. It wouldn't be his last meal. That would come on July 17, 1996, over a decade later, after having finally lost his virginity to some Irish lady during an arranged visit, after having exhausted all appeals. That meal would be a pizza with green peppers and onions, strawberry cheesecake, and black coffee. John Jubert, at the age of 33, died in Nebraska's electric chair. He had been concerned that it was going to hurt, and it did. An autopsy showed that, yes, electrocution killed him, but along the way, an unusual 4-inch blister developed on the top of his head. I'm assuming that's where his hell-bound soul climbed out. And that'll do it. A little abrupt at the end there. I'm just out of steam. There's more. You can read the book. There's not much more. I told the story my way. I am the grandmaster of this podcast, as I mentioned, after all. So you got the story, but I'm not putting on that cough, by the way. So what's, excuse me. I am very sick, and that's why there hasn't been any content coming out. But frig, I gotta get going at some point here. So I push through, and I hope that you understand. I highly recommend the book I read to further understand this case, written by reporter Mark Pettit, who gained exclusive access to John Jubert. It's not Jubert, it's Jubert, back in the late 80s, and continued to correspond up until the killer's execution in 1996. John Jubert is a real fucking piece of shit. He acts like a scorned child all the time in his interviews, acts like he's, or he acted until he was executed, like someone who should be forgiven. And I hope that I convince you that he shouldn't have been. The book's name is A Need to Kill, the true crime account of John Jubert, Nebraska's most notorious serial child killer. There's a link in the show notes. Also, there's a video link in the notes to the archives of KETV out of Omaha that is excellent as well, if you want to see what he looked like and, you know, see the victims and all that. There are some crime scene photos that are really brutal. And that's on the Forensic Files doc. I didn't include that because there's some information that is wrong in the Forensic Files documentary. I always trusted that, but I guess they just focus on the forensic aspect and the storytelling isn't as, I don't know, buttoned up. But if you do want to see the fucking dead kids, then you can search out the Forensic Files. You know what? I'll put it in the show notes too. If you're hungry for more, check out Dark Topic Plus, also linked in the show notes. I want to do a few shout outs here for the high level support on Patreon. CBD is Crete. Thank you very much, CBD. Harry Balsagna. Balsagna? Thanks, Harry. And Pink. Thank you, Pink. If I missed anybody and you want a shout out, please reach out to me. I've kind of lost track of some of this stuff here. And thank you for high level support. Thank you, everybody who comes over to Dark Topic Plus and on Apple, and you can sign up through Spotify now, and you can go to Patreon, as always. Dark Topic Plus includes exclusive episodes. I do, you know, more Dark Topic on there. Jack Luna's Dark Fiction, Brutal, I do with Kent from True Crime Kent. The Luna Bin with my brother Leroy, of Excuse Me, That's Illegal. And you get the knowledge that you're helping to keep the lights on at Dark Topic. Are you sold? No. How? Oh, I got a big spiel here. I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. I've been told I need to try to sell myself better. I'm tired of this. I'm not going to do it. You want to hear it? All right, let's hear my sales pitch. Sold? No? How about 75% off your first month on Patreon or a free trial on Apple Plus just to get you in the door? Get in here. Get the fuck in here. You're literally going to make me twist your arm? Oh, shit, you're strong. Fuck, fine. You don't have to run away. That's okay. I'll hit you next time on the head with another episode of Dark Topic. Until then, keep your eyes cocked, your doors locked, and stay paranoid. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll talk at you real soon. I appreciate your patience, and I'll get better. I'm on the mend, believe it or not. Thank you.
In cybersecurity, speed is survival. SOC Radar is your early warning system, monitoring external threats to your company to spot risks before breaches. SOC Radar delivers proactive threat intelligence with actionable insights for holistic exposure management across attack surfaces, dark web, and brand protection. With automated detection, triage, and investigation, SOC Radar is your business's frontline defense. Start your free trial at socradar.io/podcast. That's socradar.io/podcast. Don't wait.